thank you for downloading or streaming today's episode of the PW Torch Livecast. In just a couple minutes, we'll get you to the show. But first, I want to let you know about our big $1 VIP sale. If you have not become a PW Torch VIP member, this is the best time of year to do it. We are running our $1 sale in association with it being SummerSlam month. We are creating a SummerSlam special section on the PW Torch VIP website that will feature links to our SummerSlam reports dating back to when the Pro Wrestling Torch newsletter started in the late 1980s through this year's. We're also creating a collection of our post-SummerSlam pay-per-view roundtables dating back to the mid-2000s. The last dozen SummerSlams have been covered with post-pay-per-view roundtables since we launched the PW Torch VIP website in the mid-2000s, and you can subscribe to that feed on your smartphone and listen to what we had to say the night of SummerSlam for the last dozen years. And you can subscribe to it exclusively as a VIP member on your smartphone or in iTunes. Just like all VIP audio, you can subscribe on your iPhone, Android, or through iTunes, or stream it directly from our ad-free VIP website, which is mobile-friendly and desktop-friendly. You also get everything else that comes with a VIP membership, ad-free access to our website, exclusive articles, the new weekly Pro Wrestling Torch newsletter, over 1,500 back issues of the Pro Wrestling Torch newsletter chronicling wrestling history in depth, the biggest stories, the biggest events, obscure house show results, TV reports, exclusive columns, cover stories, and so much more. 1,500 plus back issues dating back to the late 1980s. Also, in the month of July, we posted over 130 podcasts for our VIP members. The live casts are great. They're even better when the commercials are edited out. And that's a bonus for VIP members. The commercials are edited out of the PW Torch live casts, and they're available for your convenience on our VIP audio feed, in addition to VIP exclusive shows that only VIP members listen to. I host The Fix with Todd Martin midweek for about 2 hours, and the Bruce Mitchell Audio Show on weekends for about 2 hours. The two top wrestling analysts in the business are part of PW Torch VIP every week. I also record the Wade Keller Hotline every single day. I've recorded it every single day for 8 years. No days off. You wake up, and there it is, the Wade Keller Hotline with the latest breaking news, my answers to VIP member questions, and every Monday night and Tuesday night, a detailed rundown with my analysis of both Raw and SmackDown. So much more comes with the VIP membership. Get full details at pwtorch.com/govip. And the coupon code for our sale is livecast2017. No space, lowercase, livecast2017. Enter that in the promo code box on our mobile-friendly sign-up form, and you are in for $1 for one full month. Or you can take that $9 discount and apply it to a three-month or a one-year subscription. That means that a $99 subscription for 1 year gets dropped down to $90, which equates to paying just on average $7.50 a month for the next year. If you are a fan of our work here on the PW Torch Livecast and my new show, the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast over at Podcast One, you will love the PW Torch VIP audio lineup. So go VIP for $1 or take $9 off a longer-term subscription. This offer expires soon. Don't miss out. pwtorch.com/govip. Enter promo code LiveCast2017. That's LiveCast2017. No space in there. LiveCast2017. We'd love to have you as a member. We'd love to earn your business for the long run. Find out what people love about their PW Torch VIP membership and get more of what you love in terms of pro wrestling podcasts brought to you by the team at Pro Wrestling Torch.
Blog Talk Radio.
ongoing wrestling exhibition requires discretionary viewer participation.
From the Polyester Pleasure Palace on the shores of Lake Washington, or as close as I can get in my price range, it's Jim Valley, the show Wrestling Road Stories, taking you back to a time when the beer was cold, the rats were hot, people believed it was real, and we sold out everywhere. Everywhere! Yes, indeed, Wrestling Road Stories, the show with as many people listening as were in their seats at the Barclays Center watching the first SummerSlam match live this year. SummerSlam. We'll talk about SummerSlam a little bit later on, but first I want to mention, coming up on the show today, it's going to be a fun one. As I've mentioned before, Wrestling Road Stories is not about the big stars. I can't get on podcast one and get all the big stars on the show, but what we can do is tell great stories about days gone by that you're probably not going to hear anywhere else. Just like last week, as we're back live this week, last week we had Tom Zenk from 2001, and he was crazy as always. If you weren't a wrestling fan back then, I'll tell you what, he was all the buzz, and then he suddenly disappeared. And I don't know this, I don't know that anybody knows this except for maybe his close friends, but the wide belief is that Jerry McDivitt shut him up. And that's the belief. That is allegedly. No one knows for sure, but it just seems odd that you go from talking a lot to never being heard from again. But thank you for downloading that. Got a lot of replay. Got a lot of feedback on social for that, so thank you. You can follow me on social. I'm on Twitter at Jim Valley, J-I-M-V-A-L-L-E-Y. Or you can add me on Facebook. Just add me there on Facebook at Jim Valley. You should have my picture there. I think my profile is me wearing headphones in this very room that I'm in right now here in the Polyester Pleasure Palace. So you can add me there. And the only rule is, of course, don't be a webcam girl. Are you getting a ton of those too? I swear I'm getting like every day there's like these girls. And I'm just like, I don't need to see your lady business. I'm good. I'm good. Don't need any lady business. So anyway, add me on Facebook. And by the way, send me a message, especially if we don't have any common friends, just so I know that you're not a bot or a webcam girl. So if we have common friends, usually I can look and see, oh yeah, we got a couple of the same friends, and I kind of get that you heard me through the show, and that's great. That's cool. So we do that. But if, you know, if by chance we don't have any common friends, just send me a message so I know that you're not a webcam girl. I'm happily married. I don't need to see anybody's lady business. I'm good. Thank you. It's just annoying. Did you ever have MySpace? Were you around for MySpace? Oh my God. It just seems like MySpace now where everything is, come see my webcam. Follow me for sexy pictures. I'm like, no, thank you. I'm good. Thank you though. Not going to get any money out of me. This is a free show. I'm not asking for any money out of you. And today it's going to be a lot of fun. A guy that I met at Cauliflower Alley this past year, his name's Bradley Craig. He's from Scotland. And he co-wrote Jeannie Clark's book, Through the Broken Glass. And he's also the founder of the Scottish Wrestling Hall of Fame. And he's also involved with the British Wrestling Hall of Fame and the British Wrestlers Reunion and a bunch of stuff like that. So we'll talk British wrestling. We'll talk the history of it. We'll talk about his Hall of Fame. Now, this is what I think is interesting, is a lot of people want Halls of Fame, but if you look, the WWE does not even have a physical Hall of Fame. Even they understand that a physical Hall of Fame probably is not going to make a lot of money. And Bradley was able to come up with a very creative idea to have a physical Hall of Fame. So that's pretty genius. So we'll talk about what he did and how he did that. Plus, he went to the recent Ring of Honor, one of the Ring of Honor house shows, the tour of the UK. He went net to Edinburgh. So we'll talk about Ring of Honor. We'll talk about all of that stuff. And that's coming up in just a couple of minutes. And Bradley, like I said, you may not know who he is, but he is freaking hilarious. He's really funny. He does a he does a Kevin Von Erich impersonation. Maybe we can get it out of him. We'll talk the serious stuff. We'll talk the all that good stuff, and then maybe we'll have some fun at the end. So we'll make that happen. So next week, speaking of making it happen, since I love me some Tennessee wrestling, next week we're going to have Bo James on, Tennessee wrestling historian. Basically, he knows a lot about the continental side, the east side of the Tennessee territory. So we'll talk about a lot of that because I'm fascinated by Tennessee wrestling. I love Tennessee wrestling. So we'll see if we can. So next week, Bo James, we'll talk about that. Oh, by the way, if you want to dial in, I'm already getting people dialing in, which is great. I love that. Thank you for dialing in. Thank you for listening. I appreciate it. The phone number is 515-605-9345, 515-605-9345. You can call in. Also, you can email at pwtorchlivecast@gmail.com. If you do want to email, I do read the emails while I'm online here during the show. And also, again, for Twitter, you can follow me on Twitter. You want to tweet anything in, it's at Jim Valley, J-I-M-V-A-L-L-E-Y. Why? Because I like you. So do that if you want to interact with the show. But I like interaction. I know a lot of people listen to podcasts. They download it later and they listen, which is cool. I get the whole time shifting thing. But I like to be interactive when we can. And so since so few of the shows are interactive, if you want to be interactive, you got a few minutes, please dial up or call in, Twitter me, whatever you want to do. But I like interaction. It's fun. So SummerSlam, I don't know if I'm getting old or maybe I just had really high expectations, but I was not a big fan of this year's SummerSlam. I thought the main event was good, but everything else, I don't know, I wasn't that thrilled with. I thought the tag team match on the main card was pretty entertaining. I thought that was great, but I don't know. I wasn't even that big of a fan of the women's title matches. I didn't think either of them were particularly good. I thought that the legit boss, Sasha, and I'm having a blank here. I don't know why I am. I apologize. Anyway, I thought that match, the Raw match was particularly good, but I kind of missed out on the story. I thought it needed a story. We also, speaking of stories, we also need to do a show on shark cage matches with the shark cage, with Enzo sliding out of the shark cage. We need to get an expert on to talk about shark cages. Alexa Bliss, by the way, I don't know what the hell my problem was there. That was weird. You know, I was sick for a long time and sometimes I wonder if it was my sickness that makes me forgetful sometimes, or I'm just getting older. I don't know what it is, but it's weird. So I want to talk briefly about SummerSlam. And I've mentioned before in the past that Royal Rumble is one of my favorite cards. And I think maybe I've become more of a SummerSlam guy and less of a WrestleMania guy. And I'm thinking because WrestleMania is very much about the mainstream and getting mainstream publicity and mainstream stars doing very basic things for a mainstream audience. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But I'm thinking maybe SummerSlam is more the wrestling fans' card. I mean, when you look back at some of the great matches and things that were on SummerSlam, of course, there's Bret Hart and the British Bulldog with an awesome match. The infamous match between Hulk Hogan and Shawn Michaels, where Shawn oversold everything. The classic walk-in brawl from The Undertaker and Stone Cold Steve Austin. When we thought we saw history with CM Punk and John Cena. When John Cena just got killed by Brock Lesnar. Randy Orton and Brock Lesnar last year. I mean, just so many crazy things. The Elimination Chamber, where Shawn won the title when he came back. And of course, John Cena and Daniel Bryan, when Daniel Bryan beat John Cena for like a minute. You know, there's some pretty cool stuff. The Nexus at SummerSlam. There's some pretty cool things that have happened at SummerSlam. This year, not so much, but I'm willing to give it a pass. You can't do great things each and every time. But still, maybe I'm more of a SummerSlam and Royal Rumble guy. At least that's what I'm beginning to think. Is SummerSlam more the card for wrestling fans? that's kind of my thought there. At least that's what I'm thinking. Tweet me about that at Jim Valley if you have some thoughts on SummerSlam versus WrestleMania for wrestling fans. Maybe that's more our card because it only appeals a little bit to a mainstream audience and not as hardcore mainstream as WrestleMania. So coming up here in a couple of minutes, I want to talk to Bradley Craig. As I mentioned, British wrestling historian. He helped Jeannie Clark write her book and a lot of things. We can talk about the history of British wrestling, and we can talk about the Scottish Wrestling Hall of Fame and just a whole bunch of stuff. And like I said, even if I'm not the biggest British wrestling guy, so if you're not, if you're going, oh God, this is going to be dry and boring and meh, no, it's not, because he is great. He became one of my good friends this past year at Cauliflower Alley. So don't worry, this won't be too inside British wrestling for you. And I think we're going to have a lot of fun with it. So Bradley Craig, we'll talk to him in just a few minutes. And don't forget, next week, we're going to be talking to Bo James for Tennessee territory, the Fuller territory, the George Gulas and Nick Gulas territory. So we'll do that next week. But Bradley Craig coming up here. It's Wrestling Road Stories. It's Jim Valley. Thanks for being here on the PW Torch Livecast.
I'm Wade Keller, editor and publisher of the Pro Wrestling Torch newsletter and former host here at PW Torch Livecast. If you're looking for my shows, they have moved as of July 2017. They're now called the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast, available through Podcast One. Enter Wade Keller on your podcast app or iTunes and subscribe to the new Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast, where I cover Raw and my first show of the week, SmackDown with my second show of the week, and then the Flagship Edition with a co-host, and we cover a broad array of pro wrestling current events, and then I end the week with a weekly interview. That's the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast, now at Podcast One. Subscribe today. Just search Wade Keller.
Wrestling Road Stories, Jim Valley, PW Torch Livecast, each and every Wednesday here in the United States, 5 p.m. Eastern, 2 o'clock, where I am here on the shores of Lake Washington. Plus, you can download it anytime at pwtorchlivecast.com. By the way, I do want to mention, you know, I do other things besides wrestling, besides the white trash wrestling. And remember, as always, you don't have to be white to be white trash. But I also do some travel stuff. My wife is a travel advisor and does a lot of high-end travel. We were just in Las Vegas for Virtuoso Travel Week, which is a high-end travel convention. So you can follow us. Also, we do some podcasts as well. We have an RSS feed. Wade's spot there reminded me. It's called The Best Trip Ever. And you can follow us on Twitter at The Best Trip Ever. And we also have some YouTube videos about some resorts in Mexico. We also took a trip to Dollywood in Tennessee, which was amazing. Don't laugh. It was a really well-appointed, fun place to go. Loved it. And then we just got back from Las Vegas, as I mentioned, for Virtuoso Travel Week. And during Travel Week, we ate at a ton of places. We have a podcast up right now. You can find it on YouTube or on your RSS feed. It's called Eating Las Vegas. So if you look up The Best Trip Ever, search that on your RSS feed, and it'll come through pretty much any podcast app. But we do all kinds of fun travel things. So if you're into travel like I am, check that out. It's called The Best Trip Ever. And follow us on Twitter if you can at The Best Trip Ever. But we're here to talk about Wrestling Road Stories of all kinds of trips all across the country back when people believed it was real and we sold out everywhere. Everywhere. But we're going to talk some British wrestling today, and I believe we're heading across the pond right now. I hope this works. I believe on the phone right now is British wrestling historian Bradley Craig. Bradley, are you there?
I certainly am, Jim. Can you hear me?
I can hear you, and I'm not positive. I think everyone else can hear us, too.
That's fantastic. But the first thing I'm going to do today is I'm going to rename your show. That's not Wrestling Stories today. It's Grappling Road Stories.
That's
okay,
right.
Grappling Road
Stories. Much like soccer and football, wrestling and grappling road stories.
What the hell is soccer? We call it football here. Okay, sir.
I don't even know how American football got the name football. It doesn't make any sense to me, but Oh, well.
It's played with the hands, so, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe it was done by an early colonist that didn't have a great grasp of the English language. I don't know. But, yeah. Hey, so how are you, Jim?
I'm lovely. So give me the intro to World of Sport, which what they always said every time.
Greetings, Grapple fans, and welcome to... And then they would insert the name of the hall where the wrestling was taking place. So in this instance, it would be, greetings, Grapple fans, and welcome to the Bridge of Dawn in Aberdeen, where Bradley Craig resides.
Lovely. Now, so how did you, let's just start from the beginning with your wrestling journey. How did you get into wrestling?
Oh, my goodness. I was a product of the 1980s, a poor childhood from the 1980s, where I grew up on action movies and Masters of the Universe, Marvel, Star Wars, all that stuff. And I just grew up on action films. And then what happened is my grandparents used to spoil me rotten with candy. I'm going to call it candy. Here we would call it sweets. And as a result, I developed a very short attention span. So when I would watch a film like Rocky, even though it had action in it, I couldn't stand having the plot get in the way when I was a kid. So then I discovered wrestling, and it was fantastic because I didn't have to go through all this character development garbage and all that. You could just see guys fight instantly, and for me, it was fantastic. So that's how I got into pro wrestling as a child, and I was just taken aback by all these amazing characters and all these gimmicks and all these diverse athletes that you used to see week in and week out. You know, because I remember when I would watch Rocky 1, for example, and I couldn't stand the character development when I was 5 years old. I had a VHS copy that was all track marks through all the character development, which wasn't quite the same as when I had the track marks across my copy of Fatal Attraction. But, you know, that's another issue.
That's a different podcast altogether.
Yeah.
So did you start out watching? Did you
called? That's the podcast called How I Became Short-Sighted. So anyway.
Did you start watching British wrestling, or was the WWF already on TV over there?
British wrestling was what I originally grew up on. That was everywhere. Every Saturday afternoon, it was a big deal. It was a big part of the sports programming here. World of Sport, for anyone that doesn't know, wasn't actually the name of the wrestling show. It was the name of a whole afternoon of sports programming. So it was similar to, I think in America, you've got ABC Wide World of Sports. Would that be right?
Back,
what you've got over
there? Yeah, I think they used to have
back
that.
In the day.
Yeah.
Okay. And World of Sport was basically a program that was like a four-hour block, and it would show you stock car racing or all these wild and wacky sports. But the thing that became a fixture every week because of its popularity was pro wrestling, and it was always in the prime spot, which was 4 o'clock onwards, just before the results for the soccer matches.
So one of the things that we were talking yesterday is that even though it is wrestling and it was a worked situation, the program and the show was presented like a legitimate sport.
That's absolutely correct. And that actually began in the 1940s. I'm going to try and not bore your audience too much. But what happened is pro wrestling in the UK developed early on, similarly to American wrestling, which, and here we had a name for it. It was All In Wrestling, where it was almost anything goes. That was everywhere in the 1930s. But in the 1940s, because there were so many outlandish antics, journalists were starting to decry wrestling and say that it was fake and it was fixed. And of course, all of the guys within the business were saying, no, it's not, it's a legitimate sport, and you can easily place bets on it. Well, because of that, there were always journalists trying to expose wrestling for what it was, and that was obviously, you know, the more entertainment aspect of it. So, believe it or not, government actually made an inquiry into professional wrestling, and it was called the Mount Evans Inquiry. And Lord Mount Evans, he was a great naval commander, a naval admiral, and he was appointed to do
to carry out a commission into professional wrestling and see, and make sure it was legitimized as a sport. And as a result, he created a set rules system. Part of it was comprised of rounds and basically to clean up the sport and develop seven weight divisions and set up the titles. So he effectively created a governing body for professional wrestling. And this led to the creation of Joint Promotions, which was a cartel of wrestling promoters who operated in a way similar to the National Wrestling Alliance did in the United States.
Was there just one British champion or one champion?
No, there were several. Because there were seven weight divisions, you had a heavyweight champion, a middleweight champion, welterweight, lightweight, et cetera, et cetera. You had seven different champions, but typically we had champions that were called world champions. Now, part of that was gimmick. They weren't necessarily world champions, and that they didn't tour. And then you had the British champion, who was similar situation to how you've got the WWE champion, and then you've got the secondary title, which might be the US title or the Intercontinental title. So yeah, we had that kind of scenario with secondary and primary belts.
So who was the guy that hooked you into wrestling? Who was your initial favorite?
Okay, I guess it would have to be Rollerball Rock, who was when I was watching World of Sport, because he just had it all at the time. You know, he's a really technical worker. He was also capable of doing the high flying style. He was so versatile in the ring, and he was a fantastic villain. You know, over here we have we didn't have heels and baby faces. We had what were known as blue eyes, who were the baby faces. And our heels were just straight off called villains, so it wasn't exactly a tough code to crack. If you weren't in the business, so when somebody said a villain, well, everyone knows what that means. But yeah, Rollerball Rocco, he was just amazing at getting the crowd riled up. And of course, it was so easy to get heat in the UK because everyone else was so squeaky clean. All the matches were so technical that even the most subtle infraction of the rules would generate massive heat because it was that technical style. And of course, what made it even easier to get heat is that the referee would warn a wrestler for being dirty in the ring by giving him a public warning. So you would get three of these before you were disqualified. But each time a villain was given a public warning, it was addressed over the house mic, so you would hear Rollerball Rocco has been awarded a public warning, and then the crowd would all boo, and it was just an easy way of getting heat, similar to the way that the emotion would build in those old WCW television title matches when they would say 5 minutes remaining in the time period, 5 minutes. And the crowd would, you know, build because of the mic announcement.
Now, Rollerball Rocco, of course, famous British wrestler, but also famous for going to Japan and having some legendary matches with Tiger Mask.
That's right. He was, and not only that, but when he, not only was he embroiled in a feud with Tiger Mask, who wrestled here under the name Sammy Lee, but also our young Keiji Yamada, who went on to become Jushin Liger. Well, fortunately for us British fans, Joint Promotions had talent trading agreements with Stampede Wrestling and New Japan Pro Wrestling. And often when guys were just starting in the business, a lot of the other promotions didn't want to expose their stars as being inexperienced rookies, so they would send them over here for seasoning. So we were so fortunate in that we had a very early Jushin Liger develop his career in the UK. Similarly, we had the Harts. The whole Hart family would get sent over here to learn their trade, but they were always assigned these awful cowboy gimmicks. So you had Cowboy Bruce Hart and Cowboy Bret Hart and Bronco Owen Hart. So yeah, it was just fantastic, zany, but interesting times to be a fan, to tell you the truth.
We're on the phone with British historian Bradley Craig. By the way, you can find him on Twitter at a handle he must have made years ago, Insane Brad Craig. And that's Craig with a C. But you can also find him on my Twitter as well. Insane Brad Craig. Were you out with your lads that night when you decided to sign up on Twitter?
That was the name that was assigned by me, to me from my university mates during a drinking exercise. So yeah, it's one of those gimmicks that stick.
You know, we've tried, you know, I think like in the 2000s, the American Wrestling Federation tried the round system. What do you think are the pros and cons of having a round system?
Okay, first off, I guess the pros are that it's really quite easy to build heat because you can have similar, you know, if people think in terms of an American context, remember that Flair would have those matches where he'd be in the submission hold just before the time limit would expire, and everyone would think that the challenger had won the match. So it was easy to build a rematch. So in terms of the rounds, so many times the champion or one of the guys would get saved by the bell. And it built suspense for future rematches. So it made everyone kind of viable in a way. It's also great at telling a story over a long period of time, because you can effectively have, say for example, a match is comprised of six rounds. You can have almost six mini matches within the overarching story of the whole match itself. So it's quite a complicated, but it takes a lot of mastery to develop it, the psychology of performing those types of matches. In terms of to fans that are not familiar with it, it can be quite challenging to get to grips when you're starting to watch vintage British wrestling from maybe an American wrestling background or a current British wrestling background. It can be quite complicated.
Do you have a preference?
Ooh, to tell you the truth, I think there's room for traditional British wrestling to come back in terms of I don't want to use the term gimmick match, but in terms of like an attraction. I mean, I grew up on WCW wrestling, to tell you the truth, primarily. In terms of when I became a super fan, that was, you know, from the age of like 10 onwards. But my introduction to wrestling was always through British wrestling. It was one of those styles that I went back as my fandom increased. I started to go backwards in time, and that's when I developed an interest into wrestling history.
All right, so we'll have to talk about your WCW years, because those are some fun, campy years. But let's kind of silo everything. Let's cover the British side. So you recently started, not that long ago, the Scottish Wrestling Hall of Fame.
That's correct. I had been going to some British wrestler reunions, and I was amazed at the stories that were being told of all these great moments from the past and all these legendary figures who so many were being forgotten about, because unlike American wrestling, there was never a tremendous categorization of British wrestling. It was never really captured on paper as much to the same degree that American wrestling has been. Obviously, American wrestling had all the great magazines, even if they were kayfabe magazines like Pro Wrestling Illustrated, The Wrestler, etc. We never really had that in the UK. And I was always concerned that British wrestling's heritage was going to get lost. So I thought it was important to try and capture what I could. Now, obviously, in the first instance, I was never going to form a British Wrestling Hall of Fame. I thought it was better to specialize into something smaller. Well, for those who aren't familiar with the United Kingdom of Great Britain, the UK comprises of four nations: Scotland, England, Wales, and Northern Ireland. Now, because I am Scottish, I thought it was advantageous to begin with a Professional Wrestling Hall of Fame for Scotland. And I also realized that there would never be funding for a physical building to support a Wrestling Hall of Fame. So I thought, how can I form a Wrestling Hall of Fame with credible public involvement and public engagement, but without the need to provide a physical building? And then I started to think about it, and you know, obviously I was engaging with the veteran wrestlers and veteran referees, promoters, etc., to find worthy candidates, and I drew up a list of candidates and spoke to all these guys and basically have formed a list of gentlemen who really need to be inducted over the next 10 years while there's appropriate time to do so. Now, to get the Hall of Fame accessible to the public, I really wanted it to be a Hall of Fame for the people. Forgive the cheesy kind of pun there, but I decided to go down the route of using public buildings to house plaques which would honor local wrestlers in the venues that they made famous. So, for example, in Dundee, Scotland's greatest ever wrestler, George Kidd, that was his home venue. And he was inducted in a ceremony at the Caird Hall in 2015. He became our first entrant. And as a result, I engaged with our local politicians, and I spoke to the Lord Provost of Dundee. Now, the Lord Provost, for American fans, is basically an equivalent figure, similar to a mayor. It's like a civic honor, similar to a mayor. And I gave the plaque to George Kidd's memory, which summarized his career and had images of him and all that. Basically, the plaque for him was gifted to the city as a gift. And because the Lord Provost, who is a civic honoree, he accepted the gift as a permanent fixture in a public hall. So I thought, wow, I've got something going here, because effectively this has become a monument with very little capital expenditure. And then that pattern continued. So when I inducted Andy Robin in 2016, again, he was inducted in Perth in a public building there. So it was largely the use of public buildings, and it allows wrestling fans to go on a pilgrimage across the nation so that they can visit one city to the next eventually and go on this wrestling pilgrimage tour, which I thought was kind of a cool idea. And it's somewhat inspired by, we've got a tourist attraction known as the Whiskey Trail. So a lot of international whiskey drinkers come to Scotland, and then they visit all the different distilleries and sample the whiskey from each distillery. I thought it was kind of a cool idea for wrestling fans to visit town to town and all these old historic wrestling venues and read up and study up on these local wrestling legends. So it kind of grew from there. And I was really amazed at the media reception. I was so surprised that we were able to secure national television coverage, national media coverage, newspaper coverage, and it's led to continued growth to the Hall of Fame. So we'll see where the future takes us, but it's now given me the credibility that I needed to approach larger projects. And I'm in the process, actually, of speaking to finalizing a deal with the UK government to establish a United Kingdom Hall of Fame, which will be a pretty big deal once it comes live.
That's pretty genius. Hang on one second there, Bradley. We're going to take a quick break and come back, but I think it's a genius solution to the issue of Hall of Fames, because if the WWE doesn't do it, you know there's no money to be made, so there probably isn't any money for any other Hall of Fame. But what a great way, using public buildings to have these plaques up there. Genius. We'll talk to Bradley and take your calls coming up next, 515-605-9345. Jim Valley, Wrestling Road Stories on the PW Torch Livecast.
We know you're a pro wrestling fan, but you might like MMA too. And if so, check out our sister site, MMATorch.com, with live fight event coverage, including UFC pay-per-views, previews of all UFC and Bellator events, the daily news digest, exclusive columns, flashbacks, and much more. Check it out. If you're a fan of MMA, you'll be a fan of MMATorch.com.
And we're here on the live cast each and every Wednesday, 5 p.m. Eastern Time, 2 p.m. Pacific here in the United States, Wrestling Road Stories. My name is Jim Valley. Thank you for listening. Thank you for the numbers. And please let your friends know if you're having a good time listening to the show. Next week, talk some Tennessee wrestling with Bo James and talk about the ghoulish side of the Tennessee territory, which should be a lot of fun. Talk about Whitey Caldwell and other pro wrestling legends from Tennessee here on Wrestling Road. But right now we're talking with British wrestling historian from Scotland, Bradley Craig. Hey, let's take a couple of calls here real quick, Bradley. Let's go to 240. You're on the live cast with Jim Valley and Bradley Craig. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
This is Ryan from Cumberland, Maryland.
What do you got
My
going on, Ryan?
My question is, back in the 1950s, what percentage of the fans do you think thought wrestling was real, and what percentage do you think thought it was fake?
In the UK?
Yes.
Certainly a high percentage bought it as a legitimate sport. Obviously, there were several doubters because, you know, you always have gimmick men that performed in certain matches, and there's always been that stigma, is pro wrestling? It's been the age-old question since forever. So, yeah, I mean, it's... Max Crabtree, the promoter, used to always say those that follow wrestling, no explanations needed, and those that are skeptical, no explanation will ever do. And I know that the Jarretts used to often say a similar phrase to that, but pro wrestling in the 1950s, it was promoting fourth, joint promotions had almost doubled in size by the 1950s and was promoting 4,500 matches. So, sorry, 4,500 cards per annum. So, whether people completely bought it or accepted it as entertainment is almost irrelevant. The fact is that people loved it and there was a market for it. And it was probably, it was the largest entertainment form in the United Kingdom at the time.
You know, I think that's one of the great myths. Hang on 1 second, Ryan. Let's explore this for a moment. I think that's one of the great myths with a lot of fans who say, oh, Vince McMahon exposed the business in 1988 or 89, whenever that thing was in New Jersey when they deregulated pro wrestling. But, you know, if you go back, there were newspaper stories at the turn of the century, and Jack Pfeffer, we talked about a couple of weeks ago, exposed the business many, many times. You know, certainly there might have been maybe more true believers at the matches, but as far as the public goes, I mean, I think it's always been out there.
That's right. And to talk about exposing the business from a British context, in the 1970s, a journalist had actually put a wire on a wrestler, and a backstage conversation about a match between Mike Marino and another wrestler was exposed in the national press. So, you know, that was a pretty difficult one for the wrestling industry to recover from. Furthermore, in the early 1980s over here, a wrestler named Jackie Palo, he wrote his autobiography, which was the first tell-all autobiography in pro wrestling being a work. Now, he was decried by all the wrestlers for exposing the business, and a lot of them were really bitter towards him and threatened to kill him because he effectively damaged a lot of their livelihoods. For the last real expose in British wrestling, it came in 1985 when a wrestler named Banger Walsh, basically explained to the Sun newspaper all the tricks of the trade regarding gigging and blading and how to take a bump. He exposed the business. So there was always exposés on pro wrestling, but, you know, it's just whether how forgiving the general public was. And, you know, the fact is that did the public ever really truly buy it? I don't know, because times have changed so much, it's almost impossible to think of a time when pro wrestling was perceived as reality, but it certainly was at one point.
And another question for you, I don't know if you know the answer to it. When Bruce Pritchard said that he was the manager of Steve Austin, is that true? And would Lenny Blossom still been the valet for Steve Austin and WCW if that was the case?
One more time about Bruce Pritchard? One more time?
Bruce Pritchard always claims that he was supposed to manage Steve Austin when he first debuted with WCW. So my question is that statement true, and would Lady Blossom still have been the valet for Steve Austin if he was to be the manager for Stone Cold Steve Austin?
Oh, that's right, yeah.
WCW.
So Bradley, on the Conrad Thompson, Bruce Pritchard podcast, Something to Wrestle, they talk about that during that time period, you know, Bruce was out of the WWF and was going to go to WCW, and there was talk about it, and for one reason or another, it didn't happen. But Dusty apparently told Bruce that he wanted him to be the mouthpiece for stunning Steve Austin. So if that would have happened, what do you think would have happened to Genie?
Okay, well, if that had happened, then there is a chance that that Genie wouldn't have been involved. But then there's also the chance that, you know, this could have been one of 20 ideas that were maybe put forward about the introduction of Steve Austin into WCW. You know, there's so many booking ideas that have always been presented back and forward that never happened. You know, there were discussions that Jim Herd had with Hulk Hogan in 1991 that never materialized. You know, but all that matters is wrestling fact and wrestling history, not what could have happened. I mean, it's easy to say that Bruce Pritchard could have taken that spot, but it didn't happen. So, you know, I don't understand why Bruce is even talking about it, because he's developed a more than successful career now. I mean, what does he want to be credited instead of being like one of the bookers from the boom period of the Attitude Era? Would he rather be famous for being the mouthpiece of Steve Austin during the dying day of BCW in the early 90s?
Well, you know, either way, though, Bradley, whether it was Bruce Pritchard or Genie Clark, Steve Austin still would have been taken to the ring by a blonde with big boobs.
That's true.
Hey, well, let's talk about Genie Clark here. Let's take a break. I got to get these things out of the way, otherwise Wade yells at me. But let's take a break. Let's get this out of the way, and then we'll come back. I do want to talk about your relationship with Genie Clark, and we'll do some more talking with the British wrestling historian Bradley Craig here on the PW Torch Livecast. It's Jim Valley. It's Wrestling Road Stories each and every Wednesday here on the Livecast.
Support what we do here at the PW Torch Livecast when you shop Amazon. Simply go to pwtorch.com/Amazon. We've simplified the page. There's a big Amazon logo. You click on it. It takes you right to Amazon's homepage. But because of that small detour, we get credit for your visit, and we get a commission on anything you buy on that shopping trip. That's pwtorch.com/Amazon. Thank you very much for your support.
It's PW Torch Livecast. It's Jim Valley. We're here Wrestling Road Stories here with Bradley Craig. Not only is he a historian, not only did he found the Scottish Wrestling Hall of Fame, but he's the co-author of Through the Broken Glass, the Genie Clark autobiography that is... Oh, gosh, it's such a sad story sometimes, just the patterns and things that happen in their life. And she's such a sweet woman. We've had her on the show. I'll have to have her on again. But so tell me about your role in that book, Bradley.
Okay, my role really evolved, actually, when it came to that book. I'd been doing a sideline. In addition to working as a wrestling historian and all that stuff, I actually had like a little interesting sideline of being the cover designer for like wrestling books. I'd designed Dennis Stamp's book cover, and I'd just been doing various bits of graphic design for pro wrestlers and for pro wrestling shows and things of that nature, because my background is that I'm a chartered architect, so I've got a graphic design awareness and knowledge base. So I originally was brought in just to be the cover designer for Genie's book, because I understood that she had a treatment already written. Now, it was actually a 65-page treatment of her time in rehab. And when I read it, because I had to understand her story to design the cover, when I read it, I said, okay, you've got some amazing stories and heartbreak here, but I want to know more, and we need to know more of why you got to this point. And it evolved that I started asking Genie more questions and more questions and more questions, and writing down the answers, to the point that I ended up becoming involved as the, believe it or not, as the principal writer for the works. And yeah, the book went from a 65-page treatment to 234 pages of content based on just constant badgering Jeannie for information and asking questions on why she made the decisions that she made in her life and how she got to the point of, you know, near death.
So what do you think, when you think of Jeannie Clark, as, you know, just from a wrestling fan's perspective, what should they keep in mind when reading the book?
From a wrestling fan's point of view?
Yeah, I mean, someone who doesn't know her.
Okay, for someone that doesn't know her, I'd like them to take away all the preconceptions, because there's an assumption that when you read a book that's by an ex-wife or an ex-husband of someone famous, there's an assumption that that person is just out to get the other more successful half and make a buck off of that person. But this is really not the case with Jeannie Clark's story. Jeannie Clark's story is a tragic but triumphant story of you know, self acceptance and a real journey from a desolate beginning, from childhood poverty, to being almost a self-made businesswoman, and a real success before she went into pro wrestling. And this is what people don't realize. She was actually a successful business person before she was lured back in to help a rookie, Steve Austin. And she actually helped his career early on. So all the people that think that Jeannie has written this book with an axe to grind, they're always amazed when they read the book, and then they're like, wow, this is not the book that I thought it was going to be, and it's a different story. This is actually Jeannie's story. It's not Steve is in the book, obviously, because he was her husband at one point, as is Chris Adams, who was her long-term boyfriend. But this is really Jeannie's story, and that's what people should take away from the book.
I like the book a lot, and not just poverty, but some really tragic family situations. So I think it's a very interesting book, and she's a lovely woman. Let's take another call here. Let's go to 248. 248, you're on the live cast of Jim Bowling and Bradley Craig. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hey, this is Ed from Detroit, Michigan. Thank you for taking my call.
Ed, thanks for calling. I appreciate it, man.
Hey, sure. First, I wanted to say something, and I had two questions. When you were talking earlier about the business being exposed, one of the big things in America you might remember was a wrestler by the name of Eddie Mansfeld, and he was on 2020, and they did a whole big story about it, and it was on Morton Downey Jr. Yeah, he used to be a partner with Dr. D. David Schultz, and there was that whole incident where John Stossel got hit, you know, on the live TV by the wrestler Dr. D, but they did like a whole hour special. This was like in 1983-84, exposing the business of blading and how the matches were scripted and whatnot, and that was on that 2020, the ABC News show.
Yep. That was a huge deal.
That was a huge deal.
Yeah. Well, real quick, if I can get my questions here for your guest, I was curious if I could get his opinion. One of my, you know, interesting things with the wrestling was on the Montreal Screwjob with Bret Hart, if I can kind of get his opinion and take on that.
Okay. Did not expect this one, so I'm going
to... Okay.
The Montreal Screwjob, obviously... you know, I've actually gotten to know Brett quite a bit through research that I've been doing on another book. And I've come to realize the type of character that Brett is. And he's a man of great integrity. So, you know, obviously, I think that a lot of the issues with the Montreal Screwjob stem from the fact that because of Brett's character, he took things very personally when he was effectively betrayed. He thought that someone that gives a word, I guess he expected when he gives his word, he expects someone's word to be good as well. And I think he felt more of a personal betrayal than a professional betrayal from the Montreal Screwjob. That's just how I perceive things. I guess I'm speaking, I can't speak for Brett, but my perception was always that he took things on a more personal level because of the relationship that he built with Vince, because Vince is a very smart promoter. He always brings his employees to think of him as more of a father figure than just the boss relationship. So when there is when someone does get pushed down the card or gets ousted from the company or something negative happens, the talent often take a more personal sense of betrayal than they would if they were just demoted from a position or whatever, because Vince is smart in that he develops this relationship with talent to get the best from them. At the end of the day, they're all talent working for him. So he's trying to get the best out of them any way he can. And if talent get hurt along the way, too bad for the talent. But at the end of the day, Vince only cares about the prosperity of his company. And he was doing what he felt was in the best interests of the company.
Okay. I had two other questions for you.
Yeah?
I'm sorry. Was I interrupting you?
No, go ahead.
No.
Okay, two other questions. My next one would be when you were talking earlier a little bit about, you mentioned you guys, the WCW, and how you're a big fan. Do you feel that if there was somebody else than Eric Bischoff running that WCW, it would have been successful, and Ted Turner would have kept it with his network and stuck with the wrestling, and kind of how much fault do you put on Eric Bischoff, if any, on the failure of the WCW and why Ted Turner, ended up selling it off? But I was wondering, just basically, if you could talk a little bit about your opinion of Eric Bischoff and how he ran the WCW.
I think Eric Bischoff was the right candidate to take over the company, because the company had been so soured by wrestling guys, and they never really perceived Eric Bischoff to be in the same ilk as the Bill Watts or the Ole Andersons or, the predecessors who'd taken over the company and failed to adapt to a corporate environment. Eric Bischoff was really the perfect guy to integrate himself into Turner Sports hierarchy and convince the company to invest in higher production values and to invest in the top talent. So I think that Eric Bischoff's corporate manner is what carried him to early success. Could there have been other guys that had maybe taken the company further, perhaps? But because of the fact that the great wrestling minds that preceded Eric, such as Bill Watts or Ole, had soured them so much, it's never going to happen. So it's all kind of like a moot point because of the fact that nobody was going to get a chance really to run it apart from someone with a corporate sensibility.
Oh, okay. Last question I had, and especially one of my favorite wrestlers when I was a kid growing up in the 80s, ironically, is a British wrestler, wrestled in America, and I wonder if you could kind of talk about him a little bit. Is with the Dynamite Kid. I've read different things about him. I guess he's living in England, and he's got some injury, and he battled some drugs and stuff like that. But I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about the Dynamite Kid, because, gosh, I loved watching him wrestle, especially, when him and Davey Boy Smith back in the day.
Okay, so do you want to know about the early days of Dynamite
Kid?
Well,
a little bit about the early days and what's going on with Dynamite Kid. I guess he's over in England, if you could tell me a little bit about him.
Go ahead. Talk about now, but then also talk about, after you give us an update, but talk about, after you're done with that, his place in British history, where you'd put him.
Okay, so I am in occasional touch with a gentleman named Mark Billington. That's actually Dynamite's brother. He generally does all of the, I don't want to say press dealings, but any kind of public announcement relating to Dynamite is done through his brother, because he's the conduit to the media, I guess. Because Dynamite Kid, as I think a lot of people in America knew, the fact that Dynamite Kid wrestled such a high-impact style and abused his body to such a degree that he's actually living in a great degree of pain. He's got significant damage to his brain, and he suffered, I believe, a stroke a year ago. And yeah, he is not physically capable of making public appearances right now. So he's in rough shape, very rough shape. In fact, there was a Kickstarter that was pulled together a couple of maybe a year or so back to try and get some home assisted care for Dynamite Kid. Dynamite's lucky that he lives in the UK because we have a national health service. So Dynamite Kid, who did not save his money from his wrestling days, he does get medical care through the National Health Service, but he does want his family want the luxury of him getting that assistance at home. So that's why there was the Kickstarter. But yeah, in terms of Dynamite Kid and his place in British wrestling history, Dynamite was one of the first true stars to cross over from the joint promotion system, the World of Sport wrestling, to making an international name for himself, first through Calgary and Stampede Wrestling, and then through New Japan. But intermittently, he would always come back to the UK between tours. And it was amazing seeing the evolution of this skinny 14-year-old who'd been trained by Ted Bettley near Wigan, get from, you know, this skinny, undersized childlike figure to just this huge powerhouse who was just on a plethora of steroids. His body transformed beyond belief. And his wrestling style, he never really changed it from being that high-impact, acrobatic, and physical style. But this was before people knew the implications of concussions and the physical abuse of those diving headbutts and snap suplexes that would hamper his spine. It was the snap suplexes that destroyed his spine, and you could argue that it was the diving headbutts that caused the great concussions that ended up affecting his psyche and caused him moments of rage. And he burnt the candle at both ends, and I think now he's basically paying the price, as is categorized in his book. But more so now than ever.
One of the things I've wondered about him is, obviously, with a lot of wrestlers, he doesn't have the best reputation, kind of a bully. We all know the story. Had he been involved in British wrestling to develop long enough before he came to America to develop any sort of reputation in that regard?
The British wrestling was so closed book. So it was such a hard industry to break into, that most of the British wrestlers were legitimate hard guys. And I understand from speaking to the likes of Marty Jones, who was trained by Billy Robinson and other luminaries within the British wrestling industry, that Dynamite never was a problem backstage because all of the guys were great shooters themselves. So that wasn't a problem, because most British wrestlers broke into the business the hard way. They were catch wrestlers to begin with. And then they were slowly ingrained into professional wrestling. And a lot of the guys over here, when they started the pro scene, they were normally put in with like a legendary shooter who would take total liberties with them for their first, like, maybe 10 or so matches, until they realized that they had what it takes. And then they kind of said, okay, we're going to work a bit looser, and we're going to take it easy tonight, kid. You know, that was the mentality of British wrestling at the time, was to try and, you know, beat up on the guys and see if they had what it takes. And then the guys that come back, then give them a chance.
Where do you put him as far as British wrestlers? Would he be in a, is he in a Hall of Fame?
Oh, absolutely. He's one of the top. Well, again, it depends on your criteria. In terms of public image of pro wrestling, his matches were amongst the best pro wrestling matches of any generation. In terms of his body of work, it was fantastic. But in terms of his personal life and the image he portrayed as an ambassador of the sport, you know, there's debate there whether or not he matches the criteria. You know, you look at the ambassador role that Johnny Saint has played in professional wrestling, another great UK veteran, and he's paid tremendous service to pro wrestling because he's helped cultivate the next generation of talent and always carried himself as a champion and was really media friendly whenever he was approached for interviews, and he was always fan friendly. Dynamite Kid was very much a hermit and wasn't media friendly, and in fact sometimes he was just outright fierce to fans and the media. So you know, there are aspects of the Dynamite Kid where he falls short, but in terms of being an in-ring worker, so to speak, there was nobody better in terms of a British wrestler.
What about let's do this. Let's take a break. When we come back, I do want to talk about your WCW experience as a young fan. So we'll take a break, talk about that embarrassing period in WCW, not for you, but for wrestling. We'll do that, and we'll come back. Wrestling Road Stories, it's Jim Valley here on the PW Torch Livecast each and every Wednesday.
Thank you for being a PW Torch Livecast listener. As of mid-July 2017, the PW Torch Livecast lineup has undergone some changes. My shows have moved to a new feed, the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast, available at Podcast One, or just search Wade Keller in your podcast app. But there's tons of great content every week, including Saturdays at 6 Eastern, the new Deep Dive with Rich Fan, covering a single topic in professional wrestling in depth. Join him live with phone calls at 6 Eastern every Saturday. Sunday nights at 8 Eastern, it is Wrestling Night in America with Pat McNeil and Greg Parks, where they focus on the supercards, the big events coming up in pro wrestling, or review the latest one. That's at 8 Eastern, or following a live pay-per-view, if there's a live pay-per-view on that Sunday. And then check out MMA Talk for pro wrestling fans every Monday night at 7 Eastern, hosted by Mike Hisko and other MMA Torch contributors. It's a chance for fans of both pro wrestling and MMA who share that in common to talk about the latest happenings in the world of mixed martial arts. Tuesdays, it's the best of PW Torch Livecast, a handpicked episode from our history that gives you a chance to catch up on a show you might have missed back in our earlier years. And then the PW Torch Nostalgia Hour with Jim Valley is back. It used to be called Saturday Morning Wrestling. Now it's Wednesdays at 5 Eastern. He takes your live calls and interviews some of the big names from pro wrestling's past. And then Thursday nights, following GFW Impact, it's Mike McMahon and Andrew Sochak with a recap of the just-concluded Impact Wrestling show on Pop TV. So as soon as Impact goes off the air in the United States on Pop TV, join Mike and Andrew live right here at pwtorchlivecast.com. They'll be taking your calls. That's the new lineup of the PW Torch Livecast. Great diverse mix of shows with a great group of hosts. Keep listening and keep spreading the word, and give us a 5-star rating over at iTunes with some kind comments in the listener comment section about which shows you like and why. That's PW Torch Livecast, new lineup. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Wrestling Road Stories each and every Wednesday here on the PW Torch Livecast. By the way, I also do a show, if you're a PW Torch VIP member, and if you're not, you really should be, with Pat McNeil. It's called The Wayback Playback, and we watch usually a pay-per-view on the WWE Network in real time and comment on it. Sometimes we make funny comments. We talk about the history of it. We make observations. It goes from the serious to the sublime as far as the comments. And right now on Pat's Twitter, at RealPatMcNeil, you can vote on what we're going to watch next. Right now in the lead is NWA Starrcade 1988, followed by Super Clash 3, and then SummerSlam 88, and then WCW Fall Brawl 97. So if you go to his Twitter, we go by what you vote on, and you can decide. Next week, we're going to talk the Tennessee Territory, the ghoulish side of the territory. We're going to talk to Bo James about that, so be sure to join us next Wednesday. And this week, we're talking some British wrestling with one of the smartest historians you're going to find, Bradley Craig. But Bradley, it's time now to lower the height of the conversation. We need to bring it down a few notches. You're too high for us. You're too smart. So here's what I want to know is, how did you make the transition from British wrestling which was a sport, to the ridiculous WCW wrestling in the early 90s. How you were just able to make that transition?
Well, it's as simple as this, Jim. It's because in 1988, British wrestling got cancelled on ITV. And then, a year later, WCW got pushed onto ITV screens in a late-night time slot. And it was just described as wrestling in our local listing. So I started taping it in the middle of the night and then watching it the next day, thinking originally that it was going to be the old British wrestling. But then I was surprised when it went up top WCW Pro Wrestling in around January 1990. And I stuck with it. It became like one of my shows that I would watch every week. And it was, you know, it wasn't the wrestling that I was used to, but I got used to it and got engrossed in the storylines and the characters. And we had a different announce team than everyone else did in the United States. All of our shows were redubbed for the international market, so we had Lance Russell calling the action.
Oh, well, that would be awesome, actually. I get that. So who sucked you in? Was it Sting, or who was your favorite?
Yeah, Sting. I was a little stinger. my mum used to work in a store called BHS, which British Home Stores, and she used to get discount from all of the clothing department there. And one of the things that they brought in around 1989, 1990. I remember when she came back from work one day, she knew that I was going to be happy because she brought home a pair of Sting Ruse. Do you guys know what the Ruse were?
For those who don't remember, go ahead and explain.
Ruse were basically a training shoe, a sneaker, that were branded with the NWA's top stars. And she brought home, my mom brought home a pair of trainers that were Sting branded. And whenever I would run on the beach, you would get these little scorpion prints all over the sand. So it was cool. It was cool.
Hang on a second. I'm looking these up right now. See if I didn't realize that they were branded. I remember the Ruse were part of the advertising for about like maybe a few months in 1990, but I just thought they were the WCW shoe. I wasn't aware there were individual shoes like for Sting or whomever.
Yeah, Sting and Lex Luger had shoes over here. I don't know if they were exactly the same in the U.S. market, but yeah, I thought it was the bee's knees.
Oh my God. So I'm watching the TV commercial, which I've never seen before. And Sting is pretending to be at the beach in his outfit and he's doing surfer movements because he was Surfer Sting, I guess. And it's kind of embarrassing.
Yeah, but I bet it's not as embarrassing as when he would next be at the beach on television, which would be in Beach Blast 93 mini movie.
Right. So you were younger. What did you think of that? What did you think of the mini movie as a little stinger?
We didn't, you know what? This was absolutely criminal. We didn't get the pay-per-views, but we had all the shows that hyped up the pay-per-views. So we had to wait for these things to be released on VHS. And, you know, your payoff would come off a year and a half later. You'd know all the results, but you would buy the VHS unless you knew somebody on the inside, like a tape trader. And then you would get your tape 6 months down the line on very, very grainy picture quality.
So I'm watching the Ruse commercial right now from 1990, I'm guessing, and Rick Steiner is on all fours wearing the shoes on his hands. We've seen the Road Warriors. We saw Lex Luger was just in a very serious black and white, like gym training situation, and now Rick Steiner wearing Ruse on his hands. But yeah, there it is. There's.
Yeah, that's not quite true to gimmick, because Rick Steiner should have been wearing two different Ruse on his hands.
You're right. He should have been. Wow. So I just knew that they were WCW. I wasn't aware that they were branded to individual wrestlers. Well, you were the bee's knees, Bradley. You were.
I thought it was cool, but then again, it was 1990, and you can get off with a lot now, you know, when you look back.
So funny. I remember when about the same time they advertised the Ruse, Remember, they had Coors Light. I'm pretty sure Coors, I think, advertising on WCW. Coors
okay,
beer.
We didn't have this. Yeah, we didn't have any of the all of our advertising would have been local UK adverts that would have taken over. We were always stripped of those integrated adverts.
Gotcha. So, you speaking of integrated in the UK, you just went to the recent Ring of Honor show that came your way in Edinburgh.
Yeah, that was absolutely fantastic, and what an array of talent! Not only Ring of Honor, but they were working in conjunction with New Japan Pro Wrestling, CMLL, and Revolution Pro Wrestling here in the UK. So, who was on the show? Well, I mean, we had Takahashi, we had Naito, Ultimo Guerrero, Rey Bucanero, the Briscoes, Cody, and Marty Scurll, and Daniels and Kazarian, just a whole bevy of great talent. It was just absolutely fantastic. From top to bottom, the card was just almost faultless. The only complaint I had was that the show overran an hour, and I had to take people to the airport at 5 a.m. So when I got home at 2:30 a.m., I wasn't the happiest camper out there, but, you know... because of my 2.5 hour sleep, but pre-work, but that's okay. You know, I'll take that for good rest, and I'll take tiredness for good wrestling any day.
What do you think? What's going on with the British wrestling scene? It seemed like earlier this year it was super red hot, and then when the ITV thing kind of fell apart, WWE hasn't really done much with its champion. How would you describe the British wrestling scene right now? It seems very odd to me.
Yeah, the systems, the whole British wrestling scene in terms of television is up in the air. Effectively, what happened is ITV put on a product which they were using they pulled together a pilot show which was broadcast on New Year's Eve, which in Scotland we call Hogmanay. They pulled together a pilot show to gauge interest in professional wrestling. Now, effectively, there wasn't the interest there for the product that was presented, but the ratings were still high. It was just that the feedback to the show was negative generally because of the product that was presented. But here's the analogy that I would put together. Effectively, ITV, by pulling together that show, they were sending up a flare, not a nature boy, just an actual, like, a signal flare, okay? They were sending up a flare to see if any wrestling fans would respond to that call. The fans did, but the other people that responded to that call was the big bear in the woods, who were the WWE, the biggest wrestling provider in the globe. And they went into war mode immediately with the production of this show. And that has effectively stifled ITV from producing further programming. Their show that was scheduled for May 26th, May 27th, their double TV tapings, was cancelled. And there's been no sign of its return. All the talent that were signed to one-year deals, a lot of them are really kicking themselves because of their contracts, they couldn't take deals that were offered with other promotions, such as Ring of Honor or New Japan Wrestling or even WWE. So it'll be interesting to see where television wrestling goes. I don't think there's the urgency that WWE has to pull together a weekly wrestling show as there would have been had the World of Sport subsequent series been in the can. But, you know, let's see where it goes. Certainly the independent scene is flourishing here, and there's a, you know, there's 97 promotions across Great Britain, 17 being in Scotland alone. It's a fantastic time to be a fan in the UK in terms of live audience wrestling. In terms of television wrestling, there are tremendous strides that need to be for real credible return to national television wrestling.
What about what culture? How do you perceive what culture right now with the whole switch from YouTube advertising?
Yeah, what culture?
I'm going to be honest. I think their international visibility is higher than their domestic visibility. They've obviously been very smart in marketing themselves in terms of their alliances with YouTube, etc. And they've got some great talent. Joe Henry, I think, is probably the most complete British wrestler working today. In fact, he was just named Wrestler of the Year at the British Wrestlers Reunion, which we can talk about later on. But in terms of What Culture, I know that there have been some internal changes within What Culture's management team as of late. How that affects their business remains to be seen. But, you know, they are certainly a company that's doing well. I wish them the best of luck.
So let's talk about that. Yeah, you were recently at the British Wrestlers Reunion. Who was all there?
Okay, well, it was a real who's who of British. For fans that are not familiar, am I getting played out here? There's some music that's coming in.
I don't know where the music's coming from.
Okay, maybe it's just my Skype. It's playing some background music. Basically, for fans that aren't familiar with the British Wrestlers Reunion, the best way to describe it would be to compare it to the Cauliflower Alley Club. But it's not been running for the same length of time as the Cauliflower Alley Club. In fact, the British Wrestlers Reunion was established in 1991, and it was something that happened 3 years after the effective death of the industry in 1988, with it being taken off television, because after television died, the British system really kind of limped on through like the holiday camps and tribute shows where guys would dress up as WWF performers and pretend to be them in these awful gimmick matches. You'd have guys like dressed as the UK Undertaker and facing like UK Kamala, which was awful. But
the Legend of Doom, I remember the Legend of Doom.
Yeah, I remember sending you that, the Legend of Doom, Johnny South, where he was dressed to look like Hawk. What a rush that was. Anyway, in 1991, the British Wrestlers had their first reunion, and it was actually held as a tribute to Cat Weasel, one of the legendary British wrestlers of the 1970s. He passed away, and some guys gathered together to share stories. And even though it was a bittersweet time because of the death of a colleague, the guys really liked hanging out together again. So they said, you know what, we're going to do this next year. And it became an annual gathering. And in 1996, the wrestlers decided to let the fans. So it was like an open invite reunion. And it was fantastic because all these veteran fans that remembered the glory days of British wrestling were able to mingle with the top stars. And, you know, some of them, it was a really interesting moment for that, because British wrestlers have always been super kayfabe, and slowly they're getting around there to admitting the secrets of the business. But yeah, the British Wrestling Reunion, it has its own awards every year. It's well attended. This year was about 300 people all together, 170 of which were wrestlers and officials and promoters. So a real who's who of British wrestlers. In terms of who was there, Rollerball Rocco was there. Johnny Saint was there. Pete Roberts, a wrestler who competed as the Super Destroyer in All Japan Pro Wrestling, he was there. Names that have actually appeared in the past have been a real who's who as well, in terms of the guys that have visited the reunion. We had Jake the Snake Roberts visit 1 year, I think it was 1996. Daniel Bryan, he visited in 2006, along with Colt Cabana and Cesaro. All those guys have paid homage at some year, because it's like the Cauliflower Alley Club, in that it's a real destination point for a pro wrestler or a serious pro wrestling fan, you know. So yeah, it was fantastic to be a part of it this year. This year I was involved in their marketing material, but also helping them with their event. I was on the selection committee for some of the awards. And what a fantastic experience it was being a part of a committee where you have tremendous veteran wrestlers on the panel.
Cool. Well, look, man, I got to get going, but you have been fabulous. I think I've learned a lot. I think you've dropped a lot of knowledge on everybody on this. How can people get in touch with you? Is there a Facebook or something for the Scottish Wrestling Hall of Fame?
Yes, yes. Now, this is going to – I'm going to leave you with a funny anecdote here, okay? There's
right.
There's a Facebook page for the Hall of Fame, but one of the the official Facebook pages – obviously, facebook.com/PWHOF Scotland. Okay. But beware that you get the right one, because one of the wrestlers who wasn't in the first year ballot has set up a page that's also called the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame for Scotland. He was angry that he wasn't the first inductee, and He decided to use the logo that I used in the invites and create a page that looks very similar, but just as a method to sell his book. So be aware of that page. Go on the features, the press releases, and the and like that. So yeah, interesting. Wrestling's always full of carnies. So.
Love the carnies. Hey, where can people follow you on Twitter?
Yeah, people can follow me on Twitter at InsaneBradCraig. I'm going to have to change that handle and then give everyone an update on when I do. But it would be a pleasure to speak to all the wrestling fans and engage with more questions that they may have. Feel free to drop me any questions on any topic. I love talking all things wrestling, not just the British style, not just irrelevant Scottish humor, just anything. So, you know, get in touch.
Yeah, we'll have to have you back where we can, you know, we were very serious here and very official, but we'll have to get you back on and have a little bit more fun next time.
Absolutely. And I hope your listeners have understood everything that I've said, because I'm always conscious of the fact that I'm Scottish. And at least in the film Trainspotting, the American audience could get subtitles for that movie. Whereas in a podcast, you can't really do that. So, you know,
I
maybe
understood.
We'll do a script.
Perfect. All right, man. Well, look, you're great. I will talk to you soon. Give my best to everybody there and Jeannie. And we'll talk soon, man.
Thank you, Jim. Appreciate it.
There's the great Bradley Craig. You can follow him on Twitter at InsaneBradCraig and talk to him about all things wrestling. He's a great, great guy. So I hope you hit him up on social wherever you can. Next week, we are going to have Bo James and talk some Tennessee wrestling again. Speaking of needing closed captioning, not his accent, but just talking Tennessee wrestling, should be a lot of fun. So next week we will do that, and we will see you next time here on Wrestling Road Stories. Thank you for listening. Thank you for the numbers. And remember, until next time, as always, you don't have to be white to be white trash. See ya.
Don't just listen to PW Torch's brand of wrestling coverage. Read it, too, every day at pwtorch.com. Join me Monday nights for my live coverage of Raw, Tuesday nights for my live coverage of SmackDown, Sunday nights for my live coverage of WWE pay-per-views, and keep up on the news and read exclusive editorials and special features every day at pwtorch.com.
Yeah.